capital of the city, so far, is still in City Hall. Reformers who had expected a characteristic Moses explosion were surprised, however. Taking his defeat gracefully, Moses had no comment to make on the day's proceedings when he left City Hall just before 7 o'clock, the Times reported. They would have understood the reason for his equanimity, and they would have been less certain of the capital's location if they had understood the significance of a scene that had taken place on the first floor of City Hall while the Board of Estimate was meeting on the second. At the foot of the graceful hanging staircase, a Moses aide had stood handing out copies of a Moses letter stating that a new study of parking garages indicated that such garages would, as the Herald Tribune put it, be losing propositions, too dubious for bondholders' money, and that the Triborough Authority had therefore reconsidered and decided not to finance them. No reporter, or, so far as can be determined, reformer, grasped the relationship between the board's action and the authorities, either at the time or later. But O'Dwyer must have, and he must therefore have realized that during his re-election campaign 33 months off, he would have no garages to point to with pride. Moses' most effective use of the power of money came during O'Dwyer's campaign to persuade the United Nations to locate in New York. The money involved was not so much Moses' own as that of other people, but of all the city's officials, only Moses had quick access to it, and he used that access so effectively that he not only played the leading role in the mayor's campaign, but made the mayor like it, and him. Bringing the newly formed World Federation to his city captured O'Dwyer's imagination as did no other project. Reminiscing, he would say, "I felt that this was the one great thing that would make New York the center of the world." Unfortunately, other cities were also anxious to be the world's center, and they had the money that New York lacked. Before his inauguration, O'Dwyer had appointed Moses chairman of a blue ribbon committee to grab the prize. Moses had selected the members with an eye to their proven willingness to bow to his leadership. Triborough board member Meyer, Bronxborough president Lyons, Big Bagman Farley, Al Smith disciple John S. Burke of B. Altman's, old friend Grover Whalen, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, and with an eye also to the wealth they could command. Meyer, Burke, Thomas J. Watson of IBM, Frederick H. Ecker of Metropolitan Life, and not one but two members of the Rockefeller clan, Winthrop W. Aldrich, and one of John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s sons who had caught Moses' keen eye. The handsome young man had a lively interest in construction, and toward whom he felt almost fatherly. Nelson. As a result, not only the necessary land, but the money to produce the items that sold projects, architectural and engineering plans, scale models, lavish brochures, were available to sell the UNO's headquarters committee. And they were available fast enough for New York to steal a march on the other cities. When the UNO's temporary headquarters had opened in October 1946, it had opened in New York, on the site Moses had selected, Flushing Meadows Park, in which the city building left over, and, since it was located in a park under Moses' jurisdiction from the 1939 World's Fair, had been transformed at a city-borne cost of $2,200,000 from a skating rink into a General Assembly building. And Moses and O'Dwyer were prepared to turn over 350 acres of the park to the UNO for its permanent headquarters. But UNO delegates didn't like the site, preferring one in Manhattan. There was no vacant site of sufficient size available there, and acquiring one would therefore require not only an immense expenditure for land acquisition and construction, and not only additional expenditures for the related access and parking improvements for the big DPL limousines, but also, the delegates made clear, absolute and permanent exemption from city real estate taxes. The delegates were also insistent on the provision of housing in the housing short city, not only for themselves, but for their staffs and the staff of the UNO Secretariat, which numbered in the hundreds. O'Dwyer felt that asking the Board of Estimate, which was being forced every 2 weeks to explain that the city had no money to build desperately needed schools, hospitals, libraries, and sewers, would be futile unless he had a gesture, something he could show to the board, some sort of public contribution to defray the cost and get the project started. But with the UNO pressuring him almost daily for an answer, he had to confess he had neither the Center City site for a permanent headquarters nor the money to build one. Meanwhile, San Francisco's mayor was in New York incognito, offering a huge site. Boston had dispatched a team, including its mayor, the governor and lieutenant governor of Massachusetts, and Christian Science Monitor editor Irwin D. Canham, to offer not only a site, but a guarantee of city funds to build headquarters and housing on it. Philadelphia, many delegates' choice, was offering the World Organization its choice of sites. UNO Secretary General Trygve Lie, himself once a municipal official in Norway, had been personally awed by Moses in their many conferences and was holding out for New York. But on November 9th, the General Assembly directed its headquarters committee to concentrate on sites in other cities, and on December 6th, a Friday, with Philadelphia so confident that it was already condemning land for the headquarters, Lie emerged from a committee meeting to telephone O'Dwyer and Moses and tell them that unless they came up with a new and better proposal, the whole thing would be over as far as New York was concerned. I had done all I could. A final decision in favor of Philadelphia was expected the following Wednesday. O'Dwyer had received another telephone call that Friday from William Zeckendorf. Zeckendorf, real estate wheeler-dealer on the grand scale, informed the mayor that for some months his confidential agents had been secretly buying up property in Turtle Bay, an area on Midtown Manhattan's eastern shore, occupied since Civil War days by slaughterhouses, packing plants, and cattle pens, in which land was cheap. He had succeeded in acquiring an option to purchase the heart of the area, a 17-acre tract bounded by 42nd Street and 49th Streets and the East River Drive and First Avenue, for only $6,500,000, or $17 per square foot, a mere fraction of the price of most Midtown real estate. He had planned to create a series of huge super blocks there, but plans and financing weren't finalized, the option was running out, and he was willing to sell the tract, the largest land parcel to become available in central New York in 25 years, to the UNO. When O'Dwyer reported the offer to Lie, the Secretary General said, "Turtle Bay, even now, could turn the tide." His remarks, however, did nothing to solve O'Dwyer's cash problem. Zeckendorf recalls that the mayor fervently said that to keep the UNO in New York, he'd give an arm, a leg, and various other parts of his body, but that none of them was particularly saleable. The name Rockefeller was suggested as a source of the cash, perhaps because the family had given the UNO's predecessor, the League of Nations, a huge donation. But O'Dwyer had no entree to the Rockefeller from whom, at that time, a gift of the necessary dimensions would have to come. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. John D. Rockefeller, who had spent long days riding over the route of the Palisades Interstate Parkway with Robert Moses. John D. Rockefeller, who had worked closely with Robert Moses in the construction of the cloisters and children's playgrounds in Fort Tryon Park. John D. Rockefeller, who had, with Moses' cooperation, worked out a land exchange with the city to help along the building of additions to Rockefeller Institute. John D. Rockefeller, whose admiration for Robert Moses was well known. In the midst of his feud with Moses, O'Dwyer turned to the coordinator as a last resort. "This is where Moses came in with Nelson Rockefeller, working on Mr. Rockefeller, his father," the mayor recalls. There were endless details to be worked out: acquisition of the land that Zeckendorf didn't control, widening of 47th Street to provide access to the site, city property that had to be included or excluded, a federal gift for construction. And there was only a little over 4 days, 96 hours, to work them out in. When the gavel slammed down to call the UNO Headquarters Committee into session on Wednesday morning, it would be too late. Saturday and Sunday were among the most tense and exciting that I can recall as Secretary General, Lie wrote. Momentous conversations were taking place backstage, steps were being taken that might snatch victory from defeat and crown these 15 months of effort with success. Ambassador Austin was now involved. There were secret consultations with the Rockefeller brothers and with their father, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. But what was happening then was known only to a selected few. There was much to be done before so extensive a real estate transaction as this could be assured. Normally, it would have taken months of business negotiations with batteries of lawyers. But in 96 hours, it was done. For every snag that arose, Moses had a knife. Teams of lawyers were prepared to research for days the details of city surrender of East River bulkheads. Moses called in a secretary and dictated on the spot, without reference to a single law book, a memorandum setting out the method, a memorandum lawyers later found to be correct down to the last comma. Legislative permission was needed for the city to close certain streets within the site and give the UNO the land. A few phone calls from Moses to Albany secured a guarantee of the permission. Late Tuesday night, about 12 hours before the headquarters committee convened, Zeckendorf, who had taken no part in the discussions following his offer and did not know if there was any chance of it being accepted, was celebrating his birthday in a private dining room at the Monte Carlo when Wallace K. Harrison, the distinguished architect and intimate of the Rockefeller family, walked in with a block-by-block map of the site bulging out of a jacket pocket, sat down at the table, tried to assume an air of nonchalance, failed, and blurted out, "Would you sell it for $8.5 million?" Zeckendorf said yes, and the next morning at 10:30, as he sat in his office nursing a hangover, the phone rang, and he heard Nelson Rockefeller say, "We've been up all night patching up the details, but it's going to work. The old man is going to give that $8.5 million to the UN, and they're going to take your property. See you soon. Goodbye." When, minutes later, the headquarters committee convened, Austin arose and announced the gift, which also included, on Rockefeller's insistence, a city commitment of $2,500,000 for property to round out the site and of additional city funds to ease traffic problems by widening 47th Street and building a half-mile-long north-south tunnel under First Avenue. And within 3 days, the General Assembly accepted it. A key factor in the acceptance had been O'Dwyer's promise of housing, and, thanks to Moses, O'Dwyer was able to keep that promise, through Metropolitan Life Insurance at Peter Cooper Village, through New York Life at Fresh Meadows Golf Course, through a Moses-conceived savings bank trust company formed to build Parkway Village in Jamaica. All housing projects arranged by Moses, in which Moses was now able to reserve whole buildings for UNO personnel. Some elements in the city, Stanley Isaacs and other radicals, objected to a city unable to provide the necessities of modern life for its people, spending millions on the UNO and giving tax exemptions on real estate that could bring the city millions more. Some members of the Board of Estimate, notably Lazarus Joseph, seconded those objections. But O'Dwyer could handle the radicals. He could handle the Board of Estimate. Not that much handling of that body was necessary, since they were highly susceptible, as the mayor had known they would be, to the argument that $8,500,000 and, as journalists were putting it, the chance to be the permanent capital of the world was being given to the city for what was represented as insignificant city contributions. No one on the board guessed that over the next 10 years those contributions would total more than $32 million. He could handle the board because he had the money, and Moses had given him that money. Letters from key figures in the negotiations revealed deep appreciation for the role Moses had played, and of the personal qualities that had made him perhaps uniquely qualified to play it. "My deepest thanks," wrote Trygva Lee, who was later to say, in the midst of a hot dispute with Moses over construction details, "I understand him, and I understand what he has done for New York. It is marvelous. I regard him as one of the greatest men of our time." "My profound thanks," wrote John D. Rockefeller. "Your instantaneous approval of the offer, your broad vision as to the future possibilities, your quick appreciation of the necessary immediate steps, and your prompt action looking toward the city's cooperation all played a vital role in bringing about the ultimate outcome. It has been a pleasure for me to be associated with you in this matter, so far-reaching in its implications, and I would have you know of my deep gratitude to you. But Lee and Rockefeller were no more appreciative than the mayor, and a letter from him expressed gratitude in the way that, to Moses, was most important. The letter, dated January 13, 1947, gave Moses complete power over all details, including those normally handled by other city agencies, relating to the construction of the UNO headquarters. His fall from grace had occurred in July 1946. By January 13, 1947, it was over. The power of money had not only brought the mayor to heel, but had made him like it. Moses not only came back, but he came back bigger than ever. Moses' man Farrell was appointed chairman of the Housing Authority. Another Moses' man, Philip J. Cruz, was appointed authority secretary, at double his previous salary. There was no more talk about enlarging the City Planning Commission. A confidential Moses memo told the mayor which highway sections we can complete by the summer of 1949, in time for O'Dwyer's re-election campaign, if we tolerate no further delays. O'Dwyer tolerated no further delays. Within weeks, families in the rights of way were being evicted, and the state DPW was awarding construction contracts to firms that did their banking with Federation, and that could be expected, through Federation's president, to contribute to O'Dwyer's re-election campaign. Moses was cocky enough to put his dominance over the mayor, who was supposedly his boss, on public display. At one Board of Estimates session, Comptroller Joseph refused to approve $144,000 in design contracts for Andrews and Clark, engineers, and Eggers and Higgins, architects, for work on Ferry Point Park, contending that engineers already employed by the city could do the work for $41,000. Turning to O'Dwyer, Moses said, "If I don't have the sufficient confidence of this administration in a matter of this kind, I don't want to be parks commissioner, and I don't want to be construction coordinator. I'm tired of this sort of thing, and I mean what I say." O'Dwyer responded to this open threat by angrily lecturing Joseph. When the comptroller protested, "I'm sorry, General, but it was not my fault," O'Dwyer replied, "It was your fault," and ordered the comptroller to patch things up with Moses. Joseph did. Most important, Moses now had his entree to the mayor back, on a regular basis. Every week, at least two leisurely Gracie Mansion breakfast conferences were reserved for Robert Moses, who would come over from his apartment a block away. Tuesdays, O'Dwyer would recall, it was all United Nations business, transacted by Moses and whomever he wanted to bring along, Trygva Lee, perhaps. On Fridays, Moses would bring along guests who, to O'Dwyer, may have been more important than the Secretary General of the World Organization. Every Friday morning, John A. Coleman recalls, he'd set aside for Moses and whatever construction people Moses wanted to bring. There were, in fact, few mornings on which, appointment or not, when O'Dwyer descended the Gracie Mansion staircase at about 10 o'clock, Moses wasn't waiting for him. Moses knew how to make the most of such entree. Says Lutsky, he'd see O'Dwyer alone, without the mayor having had an opportunity to hear the other side, and get him committed. And he had another device. By the time O'Dwyer came downstairs at 10, Moses would have been up working for 3 hours, if not longer. He would have the papers ready, and if the mayor said okay, he could get them signed right there. Despite his admiration for Moses, Lutsky saw the danger in this, a danger intensified by the fact that O'Dwyer, naturally friendly, would always agree with the last man in, the person right there. Moses got his commitments from the mayor now, without ever again arousing his ire. Moses' smiling, hearty, arm-around-the-shoulders charm that could disarm a roomful of listeners, was simply overwhelming to an individual who was sequestered alone with him morning after morning, particularly when combined with his intellect and vision and governmental ability. "You know, the city's too big," It's too big for one government, O'Dwyer was to recall. It's a tough battle, and everything falls on your head when you're mayor. I remember the lonely nights and the snowy nights and the stormy nights up there at Gracie Mansion, and I would walk up and down the porch and look over at Astoria, and I would say, "Good Lord, I'm mayor of this town." It was something. The job frightened me at times like that. But Moses, who, despite the bigness of the city, had built the great bridge to Astoria that dominated the view from that porch, would be there to lift the load, with answers, solutions, courses of action for which financing was available, courses of action that could be implemented if only the mayor would sign right here. And the mayor was now increasingly glad to get help from him. If the two of them were together, it would be Moses doing most of the talking, Paul O'Dwyer recalls. Bill was a good listener. Moses would be selling, as it were. The scene would be Bill sitting and Moses pacing and talking. My brother was essentially a reader of books, of plays, of history. Bill was essentially an artist. Bill was the dreamer in the larger sense. And Moses was the very practical, the antithesis of that. So from the standpoint of the mayor and the coordinator of construction, they complemented each other very well. However Paul may have felt about Moses, moreover, he had to admit that his brother's feelings for his coordinator went beyond professional complimentation. He liked Moses, maybe more than Moses liked him, because I don't think Moses liked anybody, he says. Soon, one of Moses' opponents recalls, all decisions that mattered in the city were being made up at Gracie Mansion, with Moses alone with the mayor. In December 1947, the Herald Tribune, for so long a Moses supporter, felt constrained to comment, plans for a future New York are being drawn up on Mr. Moses' personal drafting table and nowhere else. In the absence of adequate planning measures, without up-to-date zoning, without a master plan, the city is being replanned in camera. A dangerous measure of discretionary power has now been amassed in the hands of a single individual. But O'Dwyer's feelings, the only feelings that mattered, were spelled out in 1962 in his oral history reminiscences with a vividness that belied the passage of years. On contracts, I'd rely 100,000% on Moses, and sometimes on the question of art, the question of repairs to museums and the building of the aquarium, for instance, and things of that kind, highways, the UN building. That was all well within the coordinator's job. And that was Bob Moses. Sometimes I didn't agree with him, but in the main I paid great attention to the recommendations of Mr. Moses. One sure thing, there are very few people in this town that I think more highly of than Bob Moses. In fact, I don't think there is anyone. He gets the job done, efficiently and without extra cost. I made him the coordinator of all city contracts. I knew that would keep them clean. I also knew that it would be done with a view to giving the right kind of selection of what to do, you know. The thing is, what were the necessary things, and in what order they should be built? You have to have the very best brains on selecting what is good, what's the first thing that must be done, and the second and third, in an orderly way. That is where Moses came in. He was wonderful. And when the interviewer inquired, was it his brains, his influence? O'Dwyer replied, he has the brains and he has the influence. He has both. Early in 1948, Moses apprised O'Dwyer about Senator Taft's plans for a new slum clearance or urban renewal program. In December, while Congress was still working out the details, O'Dwyer appointed him to the chairmanship of a new Mayor's Committee on Slum Clearance, his 10th post, and allowed him to name most of the other members. Newspapers, slow to grasp the significance of the pending federal Title I slum clearance legislation, were slow to grasp the significance of Moses' appointment. The Times buried the story, 4 paragraphs long, on page 9. But on the landscape of New York's history, that appointment stands out like a mountain. Moses had been campaigning to take over federally funded housing in New York for 10 years, to the virtually unanimous dismay of those who believed in the social philosophy which underlay the government's decision to provide shelter for the impoverished among its people, and who feared that Moses' philosophy, so antithetical, would, even while he was in the process of building such housing, undermine the aims for which it was being built. By cutting Moses off the air in 1938, LaGuardia had defeated Moses in the first battle of the campaign. A new mayor had, by appointing him construction coordinator and naming his aides to the city housing authority, given him a measure of the control he coveted, but the control had been indirect and hence incomplete. But now, as of December 17, 1948, his control was complete at last. Behind the control, moreover, was power of a new immensity. Title I of the Housing Act of 1949 extended the power of eminent domain, traditionally used in America only for government-built projects, so drastically that governments could now condemn land and turn it over to individuals for them to build on it projects agreeable to government. Under Title I, whole sections of cities could be condemned, their residents evicted, the buildings in which those residents had lived demolished, and the land turned over to private individuals. Here was power new in the annals of democracy, and in New York, that power would be exercised by Robert Moses. In my opinion, urban expert Charles Adams was to say, under present redevelopment laws, Macy's could condemn Gimbel's if Robert Moses gave the word. Once, a quarter of a century before, Moses had, by deceiving the legislature into giving him the power of condemnation by appropriation, obtained immense power. W. Kingsland Macy had testified, "Mr. Moses told me personally that his power was such that he could seize my house, put me out of it, and arrest me for trespassing if I tried to get into it again," and had obtained an extension of that power, hitherto exercised only in remote mountain forest fastnesses, to Long Island. Now, he had that power not only over farms and private estates, but over the massed edifices crammed with human beings of a huge city. A Moses speech in May 1949, "If we can find a man who has a first-rate program half completed and is willing to go through the grueling business for a second term, let us keep him on," touched off a draft movement headed by John A. Coleman and including Robert Blakey, John McCarthy, president of the Fifth Avenue Coach Company, William McCormick, president of the Transit Mix Concrete Corporation, and Carmine DeSapio, who had just ousted Hugo Rogers as leader of Tammany Hall. Fusion was again in the field. The candidacy of Moses' admirer Newbold Morris was backed by men who had been Moses' allies and who were dedicated to the principles in which Moses had once believed. Moses threw the full power of his name into the scales on Tammany's side, with undisguised eagerness and enthusiasm. He appeared with O'Dwyer on campaign platforms to make campaign speeches, wrote newspaper ads to young voters, issued statements and reporters on park, traffic, and housing progress under O'Dwyer's administration, and predicted that the remaining problems in these areas were well on the way to solution. An angry Paul Windels replied that, "Perhaps the quickest way to get action would be to take the limousines and chauffeurs away from them and make them go through the subway ringer twice a day like the rest of us." The enormous strength of Moses' name and reputation as political weapons had been demonstrated by the prominence given his endorsements of LaGuardia in 1933, 1937, and 1941. In 1949, there were a greater number of discordant notes in the chorus that greeted his statements. There were letters to the editor complaining about aspects of his park or highway policies. One candidate, a young reformer named Orrin Root, running for Manhattan Borough President, attacked Moses directly for continuing to build beaches while working against allocations for municipal sewage plants that would keep the water at the beaches fit to swim in. The city's Liberal Party, at the insistence of State Chairman Adolph A. Burrell Jr., publicly declared that his power should be restricted on planning matters. But even those few discordant notes were muted by the chorus of praise. The 20th anniversary of Jones Beach was celebrated in July with appropriate pageantry. interrupting a diatribe on water wastage in New York, "For every pint saved by a good citizen, a communist will waste a dozen bathtubs, and there are hordes of communists." Westbrook Pegler bemoaned the fact that the two nominees were inferior men, and then turned to one who he felt wasn't. "There is available in New York one of the greatest administrators of public office that we have ever had who can't get nominated. That is Robert Moses. He would even make a good president of the United States. But there is no sense to labor the point, because the conspiracies and rivalries of sinister men and stupid, paltry hacks will deny us the benefit of Moses' ability, integrity, and honesty. He has been ruled out for years on the ground that he can't get along with people. He can get along with honest and competent men, all right, but not with parasites and grafters and fumbling slobs." Then there were the editorials. Most treated Moses' endorsement of O'Dwyer as proof of the mayor's integrity and progressiveness. The Herald Tribune, supporting Morris, hastened to assure readers that Morris would also keep Moses in office. "If there is anything certain in the mayoralty scrambles, it is this. No candidate on any ticket will risk announcing before election that he has plans to oust Robert Moses." Moses' support was probably not needed by O'Dwyer. The mayor was immensely popular, and, as had been the case in 1929, when LaGuardia accused Jimmy Walker's administration of underworld ties, no one was listening when Morris made the same charges about O'Dwyer. But it was helpful. The mayor's answer to these charges was to point to his programs, Moses' programs, as he did once when a reporter questioned him about Morris's latest attack, and he replied scornfully, "While we are talking about housing, he's talking about bookmakers." Moses' help to the machine was, moreover, not limited to statements. The New York City campaign of 1949 was the quintessential ribbon-cutting campaign. With the ribbon cut by the mayor and by the borough president candidates on his ticket. When Moses ran out of expressways at which opening ceremonies could be staged, he opened sections of expressways. There were frequent announcements of future public works that would solve the city's problems. Morris criticized the lack of recreational facilities in Harlem. Moses announced that the Triborough Authority would construct a footbridge across the East River to Ward's Island, thereby opening that island's recreational facilities to Harlem residents. Moses regarded O'Dwyer's re-election almost as a personal triumph. He had plenty of obvious reasons, and one known only to himself, O'Dwyer, Spargo, and at most one or two others. Shortly after the election, Spargo had written to remind the mayor that, "During your first term in office, we stayed away from the projects and sections of progress where the tenant relocation problem was most difficult," and to ask the mayor if, with the election safely out of the way, those relocations could now begin. And the mayor said that they could. Even as the inaugural ceremonies were underway, they were being carried out, with typical Moses dispatch. Many tenants were already out, their buildings already demolished. "Once you get that first stake driven," Moses was fond of saying, "no one could stop you." Now, with the evictions and demolitions, the first stake was driven, and driven deep, for the system of mighty highways he planned to lay across the face of the city. No one could stop them anymore. There was one source of irritation at the inaugural. O'Dwyer had a 33-year-old friend, a young, fast-talking reformer on the make named Jerry Finkelstein. Finkelstein understood that O'Dwyer's natural friendliness, his tendency to go along with the last guy in to see him, made the mayor a man easily swayed, or, as Finkelstein put it, played. And, as he says, "I knew how to play Bill O'Dwyer." He had already played the mayor into the vending machine concession for the city's subway stations. Now the mayor promised that at his inauguration he would appoint Finkelstein to succeed Robert F. Wagner, Jr., just elected Manhattan Borough President, as chairman of the City Planning Commission. When Finkelstein arrived for the swearing-in, however, a newspaper man who was a friend of mine showed me the list, and my name wasn't on it. Finkelstein rushed in to see O'Dwyer, and learned that Moses, wanting the commission under the gavel of a chairman he controlled, had had a chance to play him after Finkelstein. I walked in to see Bill O'Dwyer, Finkelstein recalls. My wife and family were outside. He said, Jerry, Bob thinks it ought to be a great engineer or a great architect, and I'll get you the biggest job. I said, the only job I want is the chairmanship of the City Planning Commission. He said, oh, you want that? I said, that's right. He said, you have it. He took out a pencil and wrote in Finkelstein's name at the bottom of the typed list, and Moses, confident that everything at the ceremony was going his way, saw with a shock the dark, balding, bespectacled young Jew he hardly knew walking up to take the oath. Within days, Finkelstein was proving much more than an irritation. Finkelstein knew little about city planning, but his first move, after redecorating his new office, it looked cheap. It wasn't at all commensurate with the chairman of the City Planning Commission, was to follow the advice of friends at the Citizens Union and call in Lawrence Orton to ask him about the master plan. Out came the huge maps that had been lying rolled up and out of sight behind Orton's desk for 17 years, and out came the explanations of interim developments in the city's growth that proved so clearly the need for the plan. It didn't take much intelligence to see that Orton was right, and no one ever accused Jerry Finkelstein of being stupid. And if he needed further proof, it flooded across his desk daily. One city department was planning for an eventual city population of 8 million, another for a population of 15 million. One department was spending hundreds of thousands of dollars drawing plans for a sewage treatment plant on a city-owned lot. Another was planning to build a public library on the same lot. A third was planning a school, each in ignorance of what the others were doing. While schools in older areas of the city were half empty, schools in newly developed areas, due to lack of planning, were terribly overcrowded, 40 or even 50 students being crammed into classrooms designed to hold 25 or 30, and double and even triple sessions for hundreds of thousands of students. Many newly developed areas didn't have any schools, because no one had planned schools. Children from these areas had to spend part of each school day being bused on crowded buses to the nearest schools available, often already overcrowded themselves. Studying the reports which crossed his desk, Finkelstein could see all too easily how simple and cheap it would have been to acquire vacant land for schools in these areas before they had been built up, and how hard and expensive, perhaps prohibitively expensive, it would be to acquire school sites there now. And he could also see, one could hardly help seeing, how, as the tide of development continued to flow outward toward the city's outskirts, the same mistakes which were costing the city so dearly were being repeated, day by day. Taking up Orton's ideas, Finkelstein fought for them. A month after he had taken office, he asked for a 350% increase in the Planning Commission budget, from $328,000 to $1,149,000. The bulk of the increase for an expansion in the commission staff to begin work on the master plan. Finkelstein accompanied his request with a statement that revealed that Moses wasn't the only public official who understood that public statements must be simple to be effective. The few figures it contained stood out all the more starkly. Detroit spent 18 cents per capita on city planning, Los Angeles 24 cents, Philadelphia 25 cents, San Antonio, 39 cents, New York, 4 cents. Even with his proposed increase, New York would be spending less than 12 cents, about 0.001 of the city budget. Its brief summary argued the need for a master plan, the preparation of which, Finkelstein pointedly noted, was a duty specifically placed on the commission over 10 years before, but never carried out, as cogently as anyone ever had, both on economic grounds. Duplication of planning by city departments was costing the city far more each year than the $800,000 increase that would provide a master plan and end the duplication, and on grounds that went beyond economy. New York is at present in a critical stage of its development. The precipitous increase in population since the beginning of the war, the rapid spread of development in the outlying areas, the demand for schools, traffic relief, slum clearance, housing, hospitals, and transportation all argue for effective planning now. There is need for competent review of the work of all agencies by the one. A city cannot be built economically without coordination. Without a master plan, there is no real hope left for the city. We cannot go on hauling more and more people greater and greater distances to work and back again, each morning and evening. If the city is ever to catch up with these problems and have any money left for other purposes, some more fundamental solutions must be found. With a plan, there was hope, thanks to Title I urban renewal funds so unprecedentedly generous that with them a city could make a good start on reshaping itself, if we take the fullest possible advantage of them, by planning the reshaping under a comprehensive citywide development plan rather than on a haphazard project-by-project basis. But the opportunity was fleeting. In default of action now, the golden opportunity will be lost. Moses attempted to fight, using his customary tactics. "He invited me up to one lunch," Finkelstein recalls. "I didn't go along with him, and I was never invited again. If I was part of his team, I could have had anything, but I wasn't on his team." Orton, who at a recent Moses lunch had rejected a lucrative Moses consultantship, would have been proud of him. Moses tried to work behind the scenes, first sending Hotchkiss to try to persuade the mayor's budget advisors to eliminate some of the proposed additional personnel, then going directly to the mayor. "I want to make a last protest against not only a waste of city funds, but an accumulation of crackpot planners, whose appointment lends color to the stories which have been put out that we have no intelligent planning at present, that all our improvements are hastily and ill-conceived, located at the wrong places, and therefore prodigiously stupid and wasteful." Then he went public, writing, mimeographing, and distributing to his vast mailing list, and to the press, a letter charging that Finkelstein's statement that he would save a great deal of money if his budget were trebled belongs in the funny papers. Finkelstein's suggestion that he needs a new staff to advise him on arterial improvements is a piece of impudence. "What is needed is to get some work out of the present staff," the coordinator said. A lot of old men around New York, however, still remembered the master plan and what it was supposed to do, and the days when the charter in which the master plan was embodied had been the banner behind which they marched toward their dreams for the city they loved. A traitor from their own ranks, a traitor they had helped to raise to power, had knocked the banner from their hands, and, for 10 years and more, had been trampling it into the dust. But now a young Lochinvar, or at least Finkelstein, had appeared and had snatched it up. They fell into rank behind him. Finkelstein's supporters represented a cross-section of Moses' past and an index of individuals who had helped raise him to power in the city and to keep him there. They included Burlingham, 91, with the exception of the senile Seabury, the last of the old giants of the reform movement. Isaacs, who embodied in his courtliness and integrity and devotion to principle everything that was fine in the movement. Brewer, the B of the ABCs of the Bureau of Municipal Research, in which Moses had begun his career. Proskauer, the Prosky of Prosky and Mosky, who had been one of Al Smith's inner circle along with Moses. Nathan Strauss, who had fought for many bills giving Moses power. McGoldrick, who had entered the fusion administration with him during the days when fusion thought Robert Moses was a fusionist. And, of course, George McCainany. These men had once believed that Moses was New York's great hope. Now they believed that he was the greatest threat to the city's future, and they formed a committee for an adequate city plan, to save New York from the power they had helped to give him. Within a week, letters from them were pouring into the press, including one with Burlingham's old clarity of logic and succinctness of phrase. "Much as we may admire great buildings and engineering works as monuments to the ingenuity and ability of man, we can now recognize that they cannot perform their functions properly unless they are related to their developments." Planning was, moreover, rapidly becoming almost as much a motherhood issue as parks. Prestigious civil organizations and the press lined up behind the proposed budget increase. The logic behind it was so clear that even the Times managed to grasp it. While managing to avoid criticizing Moses, a Times editorial stated, "The noble purpose set forth in the Charter of 1938 has never been realized. The primary duty of preparing a master plan for the city has never been performed, although more than a decade has passed. We support without reservation the principle involved. City Hall just cannot allow itself to accept without investigation conflicting demands of various departments." Finkelstein was constantly at pains to identify O'Dwyer with every favorable planning development and to flatter the mayor. Introducing O'Dwyer at a public hearing on the completed zoning study, he gushed, "The final result will be a tribute to Mayor O'Dwyer, Mayor O'Dwyer's legacy to the city. Time will prove that it is the richest legacy any mayor could have bestowed on the people." O'Dwyer pushed the Board of Estimate into giving Finkelstein a hefty chunk of the additional funds he had requested to hire scores of talented young planners, and publicly went on record in support of the master plan, promising that everything will be integrated within it. Finkelstein made the most of his opportunity. "O'Dwyer loved Moses," Finkelstein would recall. "He respected Moses, but I knew how to play Bill O'Dwyer. Moses would go in to see him on something and win him around to his way of thinking, but after he left, I went up there. I'd say, 'Bill, the Citizens Union is behind me on this. The papers are behind me. I know how you feel about Bob Moses, but on this, Bill, I'm right.'" O'Dwyer would agree, and Finkelstein would race straight back to his office and write and distribute a release announcing O'Dwyer's approval, so that before Moses had heard about the mayor's switch and could get him to switch back, O'Dwyer's pro-Finkelstein stand would be on the record, and therefore almost impossible for Moses to change. Time and again, Finkelstein took on Moses in this way, and won. In a series of clashes in the Planning Commission, the vote was 6-1, with Moses, who no longer showed up at any commission meetings, casting his lone vote through Hotchkiss. Orton proposed a study of proposed developments around the UN site. "Irresponsible, ill-conceived," said Hotchkiss, reading his master's words. "Mr. Moses is not the Planning Commission, but only one member," Finkelstein replied, and the 6-1 vote proved him right. Soon, to Moses' rage, the commission was even embarking on a study of criteria for playgrounds to ensure that they were built where they were most needed. But with one exception, these were only studies, no immediate threat to Moses' plans. And in the exception, the single study which posed such a threat, the only confrontation of immediate practical significance between Moses and Finkelstein and the forces Finkelstein represented, Moses used the power of money on O'Dwyer again. The crunch came over the Mid-Manhattan Elevated Expressway. On December 30, 1949, the Board of Estimate authorized Triborough to apply in the name of the city for federal funds to study the most feasible plan for an express crossing of the middle of the most crowded island in the world. On June 2, 1950, O'Dwyer announced that Triborough's study had been completed, that it had proven the most feasible plan to be the highway among the skyscrapers proposed by Triborough's chairman, that the chairman had already persuaded the federal government to pay the cost, the first installment alone would be $900,000, of plans for the 160-foot-wide road, which would run in the air along 30th Street, using the 60-foot street width and 100 feet created by tearing down the buildings lining the south side of the street, that the chairman had persuaded the Port Authority to pay the cost of planning and building a link-up with the Lincoln Tunnel, that Triborough had agreed to pay $26 million for the rest of its construction, and that the preparation of detailed blueprints would begin at once. There was ecstasy in the editorial columns. The Herald Tribune: "New York shows again the capacity of doing things in a big way. Those big builders, Bob Moses and Howard Cullman, sat down with Mayor O'Dwyer in staff session at Gracie Mansion, and the result is that New York is moving ahead at once. Big men got together and made a big decision for the common good. But there was agony among trade and civic associations. They charged that the Board of Estimate had directed Triborough to study all proposals, including one for a tunnel less destructive to Manhattan real estate and aesthetics, but that Triborough had studied only its chairman's. Representatives of 20 associations, along with Finkelstein and Manhattan Borough President Wagner, visited O'Dwyer to ask that the tunnel study be made by Finkelstein's planning commission. O'Dwyer's response was frank. He himself would prefer a tunnel, the mayor said. I don't like overhead structures. But his preferences were not important. I'm sure you can draw me a satisfactory plan for a tunnel, but all the talk in the world is no good if there isn't anyone to build it. You've got to show me someone who'll put up the money to build it. There was only one man who had that kind of money, and he would put it up only for an overhead crossing, not for one underground. Pressed hard by his visitors, the mayor finally said that he would permit the planning commission to make its own study. But, he said, such a study would be a useless waste of money, and he wasn't going to provide any city money for it. Finkelstein pointed out that the mayor's permission was therefore meaningless, since the commission had neither personnel capable of making such a study nor the funds to hire such personnel. He and his allies were not saying that an overhead crossing should not be built, Finkelstein said. They all agreed that some solution to the mid-Manhattan traffic problem was necessary. All they were asking was a chance to find out which solution would really be best for the city. Could not he have even $50,000? The mayor simply threw up his hands without even replying. No reply was necessary, of course. He was mayor of a city which couldn't afford to build a crossing. Moses could. Moses would have to be allowed to build whatever type of crossing he wanted. The mayor's stand certainly seemed pro-Moses, much too pro-Moses, to Moses' opponents. But it wasn't pro-Moses enough for Moses. Angered that O'Dwyer had dared to give permission, even meaningless permission, for an independent study, he decided to teach the mayor a lesson. The Triborough Board approved a resolution stating that the authority was no longer willing to build a mid-Manhattan crossing of any type and formally withdrawing the authority's request for federal planning funds. O'Dwyer pleaded with Moses to reconsider. Moses refused. He had made the lesson all the harsher by communicating Triborough's change of plans to O'Dwyer privately. It was the humiliated mayor who had to make the announcement that the expressway he had announced with such pride just 3 weeks before was now dead. It was all very well for Jerry Finkelstein to call Moses a spoiled crybaby who, if other boys wouldn't let him play by his own rules, would take his money and go home. It was the mayor who was still faced with the mid-Manhattan traffic crisis and with the realization that he had absolutely no way to solve it. All he could do was try, angrily but lamely, to pin the blame on others, saying, I do hope that the actions of the opponents of the elevated highway study will be a lesson to them that they can't push Bob Moses around. 30th Street and the surrounding area will have the same traffic congestion for a long time to come. The next time a tried-and-true outfit proposes a $40 million traffic improvement without expense to the city or cost to the taxpayers, I hope the Hate Moses Club will keep away from City Hall. I shall have very little welcome for them. Summoning Finkelstein to his office, he gave him an hour-long tongue-lashing so violent that when reporters crowded around Finkelstein as he left the mayor's office, the normally ebullient young man pushed past them without a word. Finkelstein still had O'Dwyer's support on the master plan, however, and the rezoning study that was to be its basis pushed ahead, with each step approved by the Planning Commission by a 6-1 vote. By August, the zoning was completed. 2 years of work and $325,000 embodied in a 290-page study and ready for public hearings scheduled to begin in September. They would be real hearings, Finkelstein promised. Some would be held in outlying sections of the city, bringing City Hall to the people instead of making the people come to City Hall. And, Finkelstein promised, the hearings would continue until everyone has been heard who has something to say. Finkelstein had already provided convincing proof that public participation could be constructive. The main source of opposition to rezoning had been expected to be the real estate industry, which had been Moses' main ally in the killing of the Tugwell Orton-spearheaded 1939 Planning Commission try for a master plan. Finkelstein had invited some of the industry's more public-spirited leaders to meet quietly with the commission. Their objections had been taken into account, some compromises, which Orton and other Planning Commission members felt on balance had actually improved the zoning plan, had been made, and the realtors' support for the plan obtained. Finkelstein had demonstrated that public participation could be constructive on small as well as large issues. Residents of Washington Square had been alarmed by builder Sam Rudin's plan to tear down the old Rhinelander houses on its north border and construct a 12-story apartment house that would destroy the scale of the square, with its park and arch bordered by low, gracious brownstones. Broad Finkelstein hints about commission zoning powers persuaded Rudin to meet with the residents, and a solution, almost unique in New York history, was worked out under which both sides got what they wanted. Rudin was allowed to build higher in the rear of the plot, away from the square, than he would otherwise have been allowed to do, and in exchange kept the front of the building lower than the cornices of the private homes. Other work on the master plan was also progressing. By August, the commission was well on its way to a division of the city into smaller areas, which would each have a voice in planning its own local improvements. An extension of Isaac's arrondissement proposal of 1939 to keep the city livable by preserving its neighborhood fabric. O'Dwyer, increasingly unhappy with the growing seriousness of the housing and traffic crises that Moses was supposed to be alleviating, convinced that part of the reason for the crises was past lack of planning, was impressed with the commission's progress. So impressed, in fact, that City Hall began to speculate about another split between the mayor and his coordinator. But O'Dwyer had not been able to escape his past. Press and public focus on his administration may have centered on appointees like Robert Moses, but the mayor had also appointed to public office other men, less visible perhaps, but just as much a part of that administration, friends of Frank Costello and Thomas Three Fingers Brown Lucchese and other racketeers. And he had appointed to public office Big Jim Moran, who had been using his new job in the fire department to extort $500,000 a year from businessmen needing departmental permits, and who had also acted as the conduit for huge contributions to O'Dwyer's 1949 re-election campaign. The president of the United Firemen's Association was later to testify, this testimony was admittedly never substantiated, that to assure the mayor's support of legislation benefiting firemen, he had handed Big Jim an envelope containing $55,000 in cash. The president also testified that in 1949 he had given the mayor himself a $10,000 campaign contribution. And now the spotlight of which Bill O'Dwyer had so long been afraid was swinging inexorably in his direction. Hardly had he been sworn in for his second term when a pudgy, flashily dressed bookmaker named Harry Gross, arrested in Brooklyn, said that he was ready to testify that he had also been a big O'Dwyer contributor, that since the mayor's first inauguration he had been paying a cool $1 million a year in ICE, part to high-level police officials who were close personal friends of the mayor, and that Moran had once invited him, along with seven other top bookmakers, to attend a meeting with the mayor himself, a meeting Gross said he had not attended because of illness, but which Moran subsequently assured him had indeed taken place. O'Dwyer's efforts to escape the spotlight had been becoming more and more desperate. During the summer of 1949, he had insisted almost frantically that he would not run for a second term, an insistence from which he could not be budged until, at a last-minute conference at midnight in Gracie Mansion, Ed Flynn brought what one observer was later to describe as real pressure. Not a month after his election victory, before he had even been sworn in for the new term he had won, he had tried quietly to file his retirement papers, an attempt which failed when Moran found out about it, retrieved the supposedly irrevocable documents from the retirement board, took them to the hospital room in which O'Dwyer was recuperating from exhaustion, and burned them before the mayor's eyes. In the first years of his administration, New York had loved Billow and believed his blarney, with the city's good government organizations giving him dinners honoring him for, among other things, keeping corruption out of city government. Those years had been years for speeches. The last year of Billow's administration was a year for whispers that the